Have you ever received news so bad that it seemed like nothing could ever be good again? Maybe it was a phone call hearing about a loved one passing away. Maybe it was the message from a doctor about a terrible diagnosis. Maybe it's something like your whole life's work going up in smoke. Something like a business plan that you've poured years and years and all of your wealth into, and it's no longer viable. Judah had just received news like this. Isaiah spoke to the king, King Hezekiah, and he said, "All of your wealth, all of your treasures, all of the things that you own are going to be taken up away. Not one thing will be left. Babylon is going to conquer this place. Even your sons will be taken away as slaves, families ripped apart." He said, made into eunuchs to serve the king of Babylon in his palace. Faced with such a future, can anything ever be good again? Our passage follows this terrible news with a call to comfort. Verse 1 was our assurance of pardon, our promise of grace. "Comfort, comfort my people," says your God. In our passage, everything hinges on this announcement. There's this great announcement that he has for us that can respond to this terrible, terrible news. And it is only a couple of verses. It's verses 9, 10, and 11. If you recall, we were reading for quite a while. But let's look at those several verses of the announcement, verses 9, 10, and 11. He says, "Get you up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God." That is the first line, and it is a very important line because it calls us to action. It says, to behold your God. And the rest of this passage helps us to do that, because in the face of news like this, in the face of trials and terribleness and things that seem to overcome us and wash over us, we don't look up to God. We look at our problems. We look at our sin that we can't seem to fight against. We look at the loss that we have endured. We look at the coming loss that we might endure. But we don't behold our God. He continues with the announcement. "Behold, the Lord God comes with might, and his arm rules for him." This is an image of a mighty conquering king, right? It rules for him. And so his arm is this big, brawny arm that will conquer enemies and will rule over with justice. It says, "Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. Justice and mercy flow from this king, this mighty king with a mighty arm." And so what do you expect this mighty conquering king to do? We read in the next verse, he says, "He will tend his flock like a shepherd." He doesn't do something mighty and fierce and violent. He does something gentle. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. Those same strong arms that conquer the foes, that rule the nation with might, will be the arms that embrace his flock. And it says, he will carry them in his bosom. You have the image of a small little lamb, tender and helpless, being held in a loving, protective embrace by strong arms of the loving shepherd. And it says, he will gently lead those that are with young. having compassion for the situation and needs of his flock. That is a powerful, wonderful message and image that we have. This is the promise of God for mercy, for restoration. This is the good news. And so, why are there 20 more verses to this? It's because we have such a hard time believing that God, knowing our weakness, he has given us avenues, he has given us arguments, he has given us images so that we will behold our God. We will look to him and see his might and not see the might of our foes, see the might of our weakness. We will see the might of our God. He goes over three main arguments. In the first section, he talks about his great power and wisdom and worth, how these things are unmatchable. And then he talks about how he is not only great, but he is greater than any other force on earth. There's no other idol or god that compares with him. There's no ruler or nation that compares with him. And then he says that even the very stars in the sky are bowed out by his power. What can compare? Let's look through each verse a little bit more closely to see these images. Verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span? That's a measuring using your arm, a span. And closed the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. He's asking these rhetorical questions because it's obvious. Well, no man can do that. Nobody can take the length of their arm and measure the sky. It's rhetorical. The answer is no one. No one but God. Because God has created all things. He knows. He knows the measure of all the dust. He knows. He laid out the sky. Who has done these things? God has done these things. He can measure the water in the hollow of his hand. Picture the hollow. Look at the hollow of your hand. How many scoops would it take for you to measure the ocean? We can't do that. But God can do that. Thinking about the power and vastness of the ocean. There are these hurricanes that are coming up and causing great devastation. And that is through the thermodynamics and storms that are coming through with vast energy and power that tear down houses. Livelihood thrown out the window, things destroyed. Who can stand against it? Who can deal with something like this? Except the God who can measure the entire weight of the ocean in the very palm of his hand. It is not something that is outside of his strength. It's not something above his creation. It is his creation. Verse 13. Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord? Or what man shows him his counsel? Whom did he consult? And who has made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and shows him the way of understanding? As a Christian, you may not often question out loud or even with the words in your mind, I don't think God is strong enough for this, or I don't think God is wise enough for this. But these questions are a jolt. They're shaking you in the shoulders and say, hey, look, you're distraught and you're doubting God, but do you understand the implications of that doubt? The implications are that God is not strong enough, or God is not wise enough, or God doesn't know. But look at the strength of God. Look at the understanding of God. Does God not know what is going to happen? Does he not foresee? Does he not understand? It's not just a matter of his knowledge. It may be a question of, is God good? If these things are happening, why can God really be good? And he says, who taught him the path of justice? It's a rhetorical question. Nobody taught him the path of justice. He created all things and the balance and justice itself, and he taught us justice. However we may differ in our minds of right and wrong, if it differs from this, then we're the ones who are not just. He is the one who defines justice. Who taught him justice? Nobody. That can't be our complaint. Well, no, it's obviously that God isn't, it's not that God's not strong enough. No, it's obviously that God doesn't know enough. It's not that he doesn't know enough. And it's not that he isn't good and just enough. And thinking upon these things, we get to refocus our mind. Yes, things can be really bad. We can hear that news, and it may seem like nothing will ever be good again. But if we behold our God, we can rest in the fact that he understands when we do not understand. He has a plan when we do not have a plan. He has power when we do not have power. He continues on in verse 17. He says, all the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. I'm sorry, the verse 16 before that. Lebanon will not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. These talk about the immeasurable worth of God, right? When it says that he accounts them as nothing, that's not saying that he does not care for mankind. But that if you were to compare the two, if you were to compare the worship that we have to offer, it does not add up. Lebanon was famous for its cedar trees. This is, people from all around knew them because of the trees that they had. And it says, Lebanon would not suffice for fuel. There's not enough trees where, in the most, in the greatest forest that you have ever heard of, to provide enough fuel to offer an appropriate and worthy offering to this God. Nor are its beasts enough for that burnt offering. It's not about putting one out of 1,000 beasts on there. If you put all 1,000 cattle that you owned on there, that doesn't compare to the worth of God. And so he follows this. And he says, to whom then will you liken God? We need to ask these questions and consider these things. When we think about livelihood being destroyed by fires, is a fire greater than God? Is its course of action, though it's unseen by us and uncontrollable by us, is that something that is outside of God's control and power? He created fuel. He created every molecule and how they interact. Everything that we've learned about nature and science, God has meticulously designed it through his wisdom and understanding. And so, are the forces of nature something too great for him? Or something outside of his control? Of course they're not. But the same is also true in our lives when things don't go wrong in our particular lives. God is. It's hard sometimes to ask, but is cancer greater than your God? No. Of course not. He has designed your body. He has designed all things. And he has this plan, this great mystery for how, no matter how terrible the news is here, he has comfort comfort for his people. We will continue talking about that in a little bit. But Isaiah continues on. He's established God's greatness in his power, his wisdom, his worth. And then he is going to compare him, right? It's not just that he's great, but he is greater than all others. To whom will you liken God, or what likeness compare with him? An idol? A craftsman casts it, a goldsmith overlays it with gold and casts it for silver chains. Talking about these idols, these things cannot be compared with the real, true Creator God. There is no God, real or imagined, no spirit anywhere that can compare with the one who spoke and light came into being, who spoke and the earth and everything on it burst into being, who spoke and the stars and the sky came into being. He holds them in his hand. Nothing can compare to that. He says, do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads it like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. God is great, but he's not just great. He is greater than all the inhabitants of the earth. There's this idea that comes up in fantasy and science fiction stories a lot of times. It's the power of the human spirit. And you've probably seen or read something that had like, well, when we all gather together and we, you know, combine our strength and our spirit, then we'll overcome the great enemy, whatever that is. And it always ends up that the human spirit will overpower because nothing can conquer the human spirit and our combined effort and our compassion and all these sorts of things. And this is an image here that all of our combined effort and strength and power and worth, it's like little grasshoppers on the ground before him. That is how great our God is, how far above he is. Verse 23 and 24, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness? Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth when he blows on them and they wither and the tempest carries them off like stubble. These comparisons are calling us to forsake the things that we want to put our faith and trust in, but will ultimately fail us. Maybe it's superstition, maybe it's vain philosophies that we want to follow and say, well, maybe this will help me because I don't know how to actually get what I want, but maybe this book, The Secret, will help me get what I want, because if I can will it enough, then I can make it happen. No, throw that idol away. Nothing compares with our God. Well, maybe it's more just about community, and I can get what I want and everything that I want through the power of the human spirit and through this nation or this group or this club or anything that where I can finally get the desires of my heart. I can finally find relief from this oppression. No, don't put your faith in that. That will fail you. God is greater than that. Maybe it's a ruler or an icon, a political ruler or a thought leader or a spiritual leader that you put all of your trust and faith in, hope in, that this will be the one who gets me what I need. This will be the one that gets me what I want. No. God is greater. He puts these comparisons up and calls us rather to behold your God. Finally, he gives us this great cosmic image in 25 and 26. To whom, then, will you compare me, that I should be like him? Says the Holy One, lift up your eyes on high and see. Who created these? He who brings out their hosts by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. I looked up what the largest star was, right? Because he's talking about, look up this night sky, look at all of these stars. Who called these things into being? Who brought them out? And the largest star that we have seen is 750 million miles. That's the diameter of this star. In our solar system, that would go from our sun out past Jupiter. That is one star. That is unfathomably large. Who can speak and bring that into being? Who can uphold it and sustain it? And yet, how many stars are in our galaxy? We don't even know. They give us a big range of 100 to, 400 billion. That's a lot. We cannot picture that number in our minds. We cannot conceive of that number in our minds. And in all of our advancements, we can't even count them. We can't even count them. Not even the ones in our own galaxy. And then we add on to that, that visible to us, this is just what's visible to us, we can see 10,000 galaxies. So if we're just averaging here, I don't even know the name of the number that large for how many stars that would be. And God brings them out. He calls them all by name. Think about that, that he has a name for every single star, and he knows it intimately and personally. And if one of them were to go missing, he would be like, hey, where's TX-31 or George or whatever he would call it. I don't know what he would call it. But it's never happened because not one of them goes missing without him knowing, right? He is in complete control of the entire cosmos. And so having this image of, oh, well, God knows and controls all of that, he pulls it back down to the people of God. And he says, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? How can you ask, how can you assert that God has not given you what you deserve, or that he cannot see your troubles, when he holds all of these stars in their orbits? He knows them by name and has complete control over each and every one. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is everlasting, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. Do not doubt. Behold your God and trust in his sovereign might. Is this your struggle? Do you have doubts when troubles arise? We read some about his unsearchable wisdom. And I want to read to you 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 9 to 13, where Paul talks about his unsearchable wisdom. He says, "But as it is written," this is starting in verse 9, "what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. These things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. For who knows a person's thought except the spirit of the person which is in him? So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. Now, we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God." And as we impart this in words, not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. Did you catch that? It's not that we have to have blind, unknowing faith because God is strong, but now, because of his Son and his Spirit that abides in you, he is revealing these things to you. And I want to read another verse in Colossians 2:2. He's praying for these people. He says he's praying that they would, that their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love, to reach all the riches of full assurance of understanding and the knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ. The knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ. Mystery is something that we don't know because it not because it's unknowable, but because it has not yet been revealed. And so for Israel, in their troubles, it was a mystery. How can God be doing this? How can we be under such distress? How can all these terrible things be happening? It's a mystery. But in Christ, the mystery and the knowledge of God is revealed. Because it was Christ who truly had all of his wealth and treasures taken away. It was Christ who is the Son who left his Father on high. It was Christ who suffered and served, not as a slave, but to free those who were enslaved. It was Christ who died so that death would no longer have a claim on you. Behold your God, this Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who gives us news so good that nothing could ever be bad again. Let's go to him in prayer.